This is 89.9 WWNO. Yes, we're headed for another art-filled week. Are you making plans or do you need some ideas? Well, you've come to the right place. Whether you're in the mood for a look at rare theater offerings or a musical marathon, well, it's all in the mixed media. Come along as we go inside the arts. Hi, I'm your host, Diane Mack. The 32nd Annual Tennessee Williams New Orleans Literary Festival kicks off this week with a variety of offerings. We look at several theater presentations, beginning uptown with a Tennessee Williams double bill by Southern Rep Theater. Joining me with a sneak peek at two rare works are director Ricky Graham, actor Evan Spiegelman, and Southern Rep's director of communication, Jenny Winstrup. Welcome.
Hey, how you doing?
Hi.
Tennessee Williams' canon of works is large and diverse, and it seems each year we are discovering little-known gems. Which works are on the double bill?
First off, we have And Tell Sad Stories of the Death of Queens, which Ricky is directing and Evan is starring in, and it's paired with the two-character play directed by Austin Pendleton in a production that's coming to us in association with Playhouse Creatures Theater Company from New York.
Now, how did you come to choose these particular works? What attracted you to them?
These are two that we haven't seen before, so this is a wonderful opportunity to get to dig in with shows you're just not going to get to see anywhere else in this limited engagement, and the opportunity to work with Irene Glazos, who's in the two-character play, was something that we just couldn't pass up.
So let's dig in, and we'll begin with the first production, And Tell Sad Stories of the Death of Queens. Ricky, what's it about?
It's about a drag queen who meets a rough trade at a bar. This is classic Tennessee territory. But because the play was written in 1957, and because the story is very realistic and the language is very realistic, perhaps that was the reason why it was never produced during his lifetime. It was a little too outré. But what is amazing is how contemporary the dialogue feels. It has its moments of poetry, but unlike some of the big, sprawling, epic Tennessee Williams plays, this one is this little microcosm of life, and even though it's about 50 minutes long, it still feels emotionally complete. I think this is the only Tennessee Williams play that I know of that has overtly gay characters who are unapologetic. In most of the other plays, any character who is gay is usually alluded to, and it's a character that doesn't even appear in the play. But in this play, they're front and center on stage.
And this one takes place during Mardi Gras?
It takes place on a Mardi Gras weekend and then about a week or so after. And it's 1957. And we feel that the play took place physically a couple of blocks down from Dixie's Bar of Music, which was a famous bar in the French Quarter on Bourbon Street, on the corner of Bourbon and Orleans, during the 40s and 50s. And it was the one gay club that was kind of acceptable. Sophisticated New York types or visiting theatrical types wouldn't mind going there. And it had a mix of musicians and restaurateurs. And then, of course, you had your quarter low life. And it was a place for gay men to meet and pick up tricks. So that's what starts our plot going.
And what are the themes that are being explored, Evan?
Candy's story is about learning to see her community and see herself for the first time. It's a character who, like many of Tennessee Williams's characters, builds a lot of fantasy around themselves in many ways to avoid looking at the real world. So I think a lot of Candy's journey is breaking that fantasy down or having that fantasy broken down for her so that she can see what she really has and what's really in front of her.
Is Candy your character?
Candy is my character, yes. This scene that I'm going to share involves Candy and Carl, played by Garrett Prejean. And he plays the rough trade who Candy brings home after a night at Dixie's. And Candy is trying to find a way to break the news to Carl that Candy likes to dress up in women's clothes from time to time. I'm going to tell you something which you may think is a lie. You are only the second man in my life. The first was Mr. Sidney Korngold. He brought me out in Atlanta when I was a chicken, just as dumb as they come, knew there was something wrong with me, but not I was queer. This man brought me out in Peachtree Street in Atlanta and asked me if I was a girl or a boy. He thought I was a girl in boy's clothing. I told him I was a boy indignantly. He said, come home with me. However, he didn't take me to his home. Mr. Korngold was a respectable married man with two kiddies. However, he had this double life downtown. He took me to a suite in a hotel, which he kept under a different name, opened a closet containing girls' clothes and wigs, told me to get into something. I did, including the wig, and he seduced me.
What did you find challenging, Evan?
To totally jump into that and immerse myself into that without judgment, I think was both one of the more challenging things, but also one of the exciting things about this character.
Now, the second work, the two-character play, how do the two works complement one another, or do they?
The two-character play, which was later revised and performed as Outcry, some people know it under that title, is a play that Tennessee really loved. He said it was his most beautiful play since A Streetcar Named Desire. And it's complicated, it's dreamlike, it blurs the lines between fantasy and reality. And it uses theater as a beautiful metaphor for the process of self-discovery. And the setup is that you have a pair of actors, a brother and sister, who need to put on a play. But as the evening goes on, it gets harder and harder to tell what is the play, what is not, who is acting, who is not. And the process of putting on the play becomes a revelatory act for them to discover the truths about each other and about themselves.
You see two aspects of Tennessee in two completely different periods, from the early 50s to the late 70s, early 80s, when he was going through a difficult time getting produced in New York. He was having some substance abuse problems. And I think all of that was trying for Tennessee to find his true voice. Tennessee always wants to find the truth, no matter how unvarnished and unbeautiful it is.
Director Ricky Graham, actor Evan Spiegelman, and Southern Reps Director of Communication Jenny Winstrup, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Southern Rep Theater presents a Tennessee Williams double bill in Loyola University's Marquette Theater. Performances run March 21st through April 1st. More info at southernrep.com. Downtown, the Tennessee Williams Theater Company of New Orleans presents legendary playwright Moises Kaufman's One Arm. It's an adaptation of a Tennessee Williams screenplay based on a short story bearing the same name. It's directed by Augustin Carrero, who joins us with actor David Williams. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Diane.
Hi, thank you.
So tell me, what inspired you to choose this work?
This work is sort of a love letter to New Orleans. So in this tricentennial year, part of our season narrative is that we're doing all New Orleans plays. And I just think that this is our first opportunity to step outside of the realm of just Tennessee Williams and do something that's Williams inspired while also using our signature playwright's beautiful words.
Now, this is a work that Tennessee did not bring to the stage.
Right. It began as a short story in the 1940s, and then he retooled it over and over again as a screenplay. He played with the idea of making a stage adaptation, but never felt it was quite ready for the stage. Now, unfortunately, it never saw a production on screen either, because the subject matter was a little bit too risque during his lifetime. But then Moises Kaufman fell in love with the screenplay, and then he adapted it for the stage so that it was able to have a new life.
What's being explored in what appears to be a dark work?
This begins in a prison cell, and Ollie, the main character, is on death row, and it's not explained yet why. And as the play progresses, you find out all of Ollie's history. He was in the Navy, and he was a boxer in the Navy, a champion boxer. And one night after a match, he's out celebrating, and there's a car accident, and he loses one arm. His entire identity is sort of taken from him in an instant. So he has to find something else to do. And since boxing was his life, He's unable to figure out what that is, so he turns to sex work. And then that leads him down a path that comes at a great cost to him personally and emotionally and psychically. And then something happens that puts him in line for the chair. And I won't tell you what that is, but that's sort of what happens and how Ollie comes to be.
And David, your character, how do you connect with Ollie?
My character's name is Sean, and Sean is also a sex worker in the French Quarter. It's the late 30s, and we can assume they've sort of met through working on the street. And the role is so fun because he slips easily between talking to characters on stage and directly addressing the audience. And as the play is sort of adapted from a screenplay, he's this almost filmic device who will tell the audience how the action is changing in front of their eyes. In a lot of ways, I'd say Sean is with the audience watching the play even more so than he's in the world with the other characters. He lays the story out. I think he's trying to investigate what's happened to his good, dear friend and someone he loves very much who's been taken from him. And he's just trying to honestly figure out how he got there. So this short speech I deliver just after Ollie has been sort of introduced to the possibility of sex work for the first time. He's fresh out of the hospital. He's eating a greasy hot dog in the park. And a young man sees him and likes the way he looks and convinces Ollie to come along with him. The young man wised Ollie up to his commodity value and how to cash in on it. Within a month, the one-armed youth was fully inured to the practices and culture of the underworld that seethed around the bars of the Vieux Carré and bench-lined walks of the park. And foreign as it was, the shock that it gave him was slight. The loss of an arm had apparently dulled his senses. With it had gone his wholesome propriety. Now there was no shame that green soap and water could not remove well enough to satisfy him.
This work tells such an honest story about what David described as the underworld in his speech. There's an entire culture of individuals that Tennessee Williams got to know in the 1930s, 40s, 50s in New Orleans. And some things just, they never change. New Orleans was so unique then, and it remains so unique now, that I think everyone will see not just one, but many characters in this play that they have seen on the street or in the bar or at the po' boy shop or somewhere. It's just such a beautiful portrait of the New Orleans that's not Mardi Gras, it's not the Garden District, but it's a part of New Orleans that we're all familiar with, and I think that's fantastic about this play.
Will the acclaimed playwright and director Moises Kaufman be in town for any of the performances?
He will. So on Saturday the 24th, which is the Saturday of the Tennessee Williams New Orleans Literary Festival, who we're producing this in collaboration with, he'll be there for that performance and a conversation afterwards. I think there's something to be said about New Orleans performers performing this New Orleans play that I think he'll be very charmed by.
Director Agustin Carrero and actor David Williams, thanks so much.
Thank you, Diane.
Thank you.
The Tennessee Williams Theater Company of New Orleans presents Moises Kaufman's One Arm, an adaptation of a Tennessee Williams screenplay and short story. Performances run March 22nd through April 7th at Zeitgeist Multidisciplinary Arts Center, 1618 Aretha Castle Haley Boulevard. More info is online at twtheaternola.com. You're listening to Inside the Arts on 89.9 WWNO, New Orleans Public Radio. I'm Diane Mack. The 20th annual Bach Around the Clock Festival gets underway this weekend with a marathon of musical and dance offerings in celebration of the Baroque composer's birth and the city's tricentennial anniversary. Organizers Albinus and Manon Prisgentis are pulling out all the stops in this milestone year. Albinus and Manon, welcome back.
Bonjour, Diane.
Thank you.
20 years, that's a major milestone. What are your thoughts as you get to this anniversary?
I don't know how we got here so quickly. You know, it's surprising at this point in my life.
One thing I notice is that
Each year, this celebration of Bach gets better and better and better. How do you continue to outdo the year before?
A lot of it is sheer magic. The fact that the community has embraced it, it has been deemed valuable to the cultural life of the city.
And Manon, this must be an awesome task for you. 29-plus hours of music. How do you organize it all?
That is also sheer magic, to love the people that ask me to be kind of hired for this particular event. And this year, we have received more phone calls, more email, and each one has been to the heart. It's like, oh, I really want to play this year. I mean, even if it's only 5 minutes, can you find a spot for me? And that really fueled me, I must say, of energy. Even if it's 2 o'clock in the morning, I'm looking at the chart and saying, if I move this one 5 minutes more, or if I take out 2 minutes more, 2 plus 2 makes 5, makes 10. And suddenly you got 15 minutes for another group. Albinus is concerned that I don't sleep too much during those days, but it's only once a year. It's very elevating for me to know that you have 20 younger people in their 20s or 30s that want to sing and dance and will do anything to be there, a place without borders for every person.
And every musical genre is represented.
Free musical genre.
You're bringing back some original organ works, Albinus.
I wasn't expecting to do any of my stuff, but
I waited for it for 15 years.
It just kind of happened. We have a dancer, Ninette Lede. She wanted to do a dance. I tried to come up with all kinds of things. Finally, I decided to do one of the ballet pieces I wrote for the Eddie Toussaint Ballet Company in Florida for a show in Quebec. Danse de Feu, the fire dance. And
La danse du feu.
So, yeah, suddenly I'm going to do that piece. And a wonderful soprano,
Vicky Thomas.
Vicky Thomas asked if she could sing one of my songs, and I said, why don't you do 3 of them? So she's going to sing Save the City, Treatise on Superfluous Things. I got the idea from a newspaper article in Chicago, and Dust Bowl, inspired by Langston Hughes' poem. The way I experienced Langston Hughes in this particular poem was this idea of autumn and coming back to the earth. You know, I can see the falling leaves and the idea of coming back to home. It's just a very moving thing. I'm going to do 4 quartet pieces by the newly formed Albinus Prigentos Quartet. Fabulously gifted musicians. Calvin Johnson, Fitzgerald Barrow, Ben Fox, based on themes that I borrowed pretty much from Bach's B minor Mass, though it may not seem quite evident, but they are definitely motives from that Mass transcribed into a manner maybe a 21st century Bach would have done.
Also for your anniversary, Bach Around the Clock is the subject of a documentary, The Heart is an Organ. How did that come about?
It's amazing that David White, Eric Laws, and some others on that wonderful staff decided they wanted to film Bach Around the Clock. It's something that's been attempted before, but they actually did it. They shot the entire thing, all 29 hours, thousands of hours of footage, multiple cameras and so on, and it's done. The amazing thing is it's being edited by James Page Jr., the son of the great Jimmy Page Led Zeppelin guitarist. I got to brag about that. It's just amazing. I've seen just snippets of what they call the sizzle.
So we're going to get a sneak peek at this year's Bach Around the Clock?
It's going to be premiere, the red carpet, yeah, Hollywood.
Now, this is a marathon that starts on Friday evening at 7 and goes all the way till midnight on Saturday. In addition to all of these special surprises, what else is on tap?
Symphonie Fantastique.
Performed by the Loyola String Orchestra, directed by our wonderful friend Jean Montes.
Why Bach? How has he touched your life, and why do you celebrate him year after year?
Because we want to be washed in genius. Music makes us human, and humanity, you can't underestimate humanity. I think music will make the world a better place, and this is one of the reasons we do this. Bach's music is definitely going to wash you. Bach's music is so wide and expansive. He could write music that is almost popsy. Occasionally we get a phone call and people say, what's all this, you know, jazz, and how come all this? You know, why don't you play more classical music? And I'm trying to be nice about this, these kinds of phone calls. But what people don't realize is that you have to be open to everything. People who participate are more interested in the relationship of Bach's music to what they do.
What are you hoping folks will take away from the experience?
That they meet someone at this festival. They meet a stranger, and the stranger is none other but themselves.
Albinus and Manon Priscintis, congratulations on your milestone 20th anniversary with Bach Around the Clock.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
It's going to be great.
The Bach Around the Clock Marathon begins Friday at 7 p.m. and runs through midnight Saturday at Trinity Episcopal Church, 1329 Jackson Avenue. That's our show for this week. Support for Inside the Arts comes from the Helles Foundation. Our program is a production of WWNO and is archived at WWNO.org. I'll be back with more ideas for your artistic palette on Tuesdays at 1 p.m., Wednesdays at 8:30 p.m., and a shortened edition on Thursday mornings at 8:45 when we'll go Inside the Arts. I'm Diane Mack.